Good morning. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, the 15th of June, year 2000. We are in the fireside room this morning with your presenter, Bob Ekblad. Today's session number is EKB 2000-4. Bob continues his Bible study series, The Promise Threatened but Claimed, with Crossing into Freedom, Reflections of Exodus 13 this morning. Let's listen in.
Today's session is, once again, from the series Exodus and Liberation, Liberation in Exodus and in today's world in the USA. And we're going to be looking at the crossing into freedom, the decisive sort of moment in Exodus when the Israelites are chased out of Egypt and then cross through the Red Sea. And this text in many ways is one of the harder ones for me to lead a Bible study on, because I've had a number of experiences of this text in the last year, and not just in the last year, over the course of my life, that make it hard for me sometimes to both read the text and remember all those stories. I mean, it's mixed together. But what we're trying to do what I've been trying to do in this series is help us all reflect together on what kind of modern equivalents of this might look like, of some of these stories might look like, and the way to come to the point of recognizing modern equivalents is to first take the text seriously and to understand the detail of the text and to be careful readers of the text, right? And then on the other hand, we need to be careful readers of our own lives. And I believe that the scriptures are a training ground for helping us identify the ways that God shows up and the ways that God works. And although sometimes some of the ways that we see that God works are actually frustrating to us. You look at the miracle stories and you say, well, why doesn't God show up in the way Jesus showed up in Galilee, healing people left and right, and crowds following him? Why doesn't God show up in a dramatic way, healing for me or for my friend or my child or whatever? The scriptures as a training ground for discernment can be a place of frustration. But I believe that a deeper read, maybe a deeper read of even some of those stories and other stories, can help us still. Anyway, this is one of the texts that is a stumbling block for a lot of people because of the miraculous nature of the liberation. But with that little introduction, I'd like to just actually continue with a little bit more introduction. The theme of this summer is the promise, heirs to the promise. We are all heirs to the promise. And in the first session on Monday, I talked about what the promise, the content of that promise a bit, based on Genesis, where God says, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. God blessed the first humans, right? And all humans were to be given this authority over the in the world. And then you have Genesis 12, where God calls Abram and says, I will, and blesses Abram and says, through your descendant, all of the nations of the earth will be blessed. Right? Will receive this blessing. And then that promise continues to be reaffirmed over and over through the generations until we get to Exodus, when it seems like the promise, it doesn't seem like, I mean, the promise is threatened in a big way, because the people want, the promise includes promise of a land, an abundant land, a land of milk and honey. And, here they are, they're stuck in Egypt. And they've lost their place of privilege that they had through Joseph, because Joseph and that whole generation dies. That's how Exodus begins, right? And then a new Pharaoh comes who doesn't remember Joseph, and so then the oppression of the Israelites starts, and the powers and principalities who were represented by Pharaoh and his officials are threatened by the promise of, by just the prolific. Well, the multiplication of the Israelite people, right? I mean, they're very fruitful. And there's all these terms that tie back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, where it says that they teemed. I mean, the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied, and they were very, very, very many, and they teemed. and all this terminology that's just like right out of that Genesis, showing the reader that hey, the promise is being fulfilled big time here. But the fulfillment of that promise was a great threat to the powers. Okay, and so then you have the scenes of Pharaoh wanting to give them harsh labor to, you know, to beat them down. And then when that didn't work, when they just multiplied even more with the harsh labor and all the oppression, then genocide, right? The midwives are supposed to kill the babies. And then after that, the Egyptians are told to kill all the baby boys, throw them in the river. And then out of all that context, there's resistance that happens. And, you know, and finally Moses is called to be a liberator. And then we see, if we read, I don't know how many of you have been reading through Exodus, but in the chapters from chapter 3 through 13, you have this major struggle going on between God and Pharaoh for the people. Okay? God is trying to pull these people out of this place of domination to a false god represented by Pharaoh, and to the servitude of that that false god has them under. I mean, the false god is using them and abusing them and controlling them and benefiting from them. God's trying to wrestle that, the people, from out of that that situation of domination, and it's not an easy task. It is a major struggle. I mean, you know, it takes 10 plagues, and so we're brought to the place where finally, because of the ultimate judgment comes upon Pharaoh with the Passover. I mean, you know, with the killing of the death of the firstborn Egyptians, which. You know, which is a brutal sort of judgment on the Israelites, and creates a lot of difficulties for a lot of people, including my kids, when they saw the Prince of Egypt, and they saw all the Israelite babies that were killed. You know, my kids were like, "How could God allow this?" I mean, you know, they were just absolutely scandalized by the death of the firstborn, right? But we're not going to get into that at this moment. But the death of the firstborn is what provokes Pharaoh to finally say, "Okay, get out of here," and that's followed by all these institutions of the Passover and institutions of the consecration of the firstborn and the festival of unleavened bread, and that brings us to the beginning of what we're going to read today, which is Exodus 13:17 and following. One of the things that I want you to keep in mind is, you know, what would be the equivalent of Pharaoh for you, you know, today in your life? You know, Pharaoh is someone who demands total allegiance and who calls the people my people. Okay, and Pharaoh is in a way, I mean, he's the oppressor. He has control over the people. But yet what we will see in the rest of Exodus is the people always want to go back to him. Okay, so this Pharaoh provides security even as the Pharaoh is exploiting and is abusive. This Pharaoh is like a security blanket that the Israelites end up missing and want to return to throughout the desert wanderings. Okay, so I don't want you to answer that now, but just keep that in mind. What is it that takes that you have allegiance to, ultimate allegiance to? Or what are the things that are sort of competing with God for your primary allegiance? Paul Tillich talks about how everyone has an ultimate concern, which functions like their God, and that we are all religious people, you know, and it's just a matter of what is our ultimate concern? What is it that orients our life? Finally, is it this God of freedom, or is it something else? And the first day we made a list of a bunch of oppressors and, you know, and forces that oppress us. And, you know, we had on the list, you know, banks and malls and money and the stock market and the internet and all kinds of things. You know, I don't know whether those are issues for you guys, but that's something we should always be thinking about. and recognize that the battle for the promise, for us to live in the promise, is truly a battle. It's a spiritual battle. And to illustrate that, I'd like us to read, someone to read for us, Exodus 13, 17 through why don't we just read the whole chapter of 14? This is a long section.
When the Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although that was nearer, for God thought, if the people face war, they may change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people by the roundabout way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. The Israelites came up out of the land of Egypt prepared for battle. And Moses took with him the bones of Joseph, who had required a solemn oath of the Israelites, saying, God will surely take notice of you, and then you must carry my bones with you from here. They set out from Succoth and camped at Etham, at the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went in front of them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them along the way, and in a pillar of fire by night to give them light, so that they might travel by day and by night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites to turn back and camp in front of Phil-Hararotha, between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal-Zephon, and you shall camp opposite it by the sea. Pharaoh will say of the Israelites, they are wandering aimlessly in the land. The wilderness has closed in on them. I will harden Pharaoh's heart. He will pursue them so that I will gain glory for myself over Pharaoh and all his army. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. And they did so.
Why don't we stop there, actually? And there's a few things that we could say here, I think, before we move on. And what do we know at this point about Pharaoh, just based on these verses?
He's a soldier.
Okay. He has an army. What else do we know?
He's obviously going to change, the Lord feels that he's going to change his mind about what he's done in terms of producing the Israelites.
Okay. Where's the very first statement that we have about Pharaoh in this reading we just read?
He let the people go.
Okay, right there, he let the people go. One of the struggles that happens throughout Exodus is a struggle between the people are constantly wondering, well, who is it that took us out here? They blame Moses for taking them out, okay? And sometimes Moses is constantly saying, no, it's not me, it's God who brought you out, you know. But the question of belief and unbelief, I mean, who is it that we're to believe actually liberated us, is a big question. I mean, how did the liberation occur? And in this beginning of this text, where the reader is given this, I mean, the seed is planted in the reader's mind. Is it Pharaoh that let the people go? In other words, is Pharaoh truly the sovereign? You know, who is the one who has control? You know, and in the opening of this pericope, in this section of scripture, it's stated Pharaoh's the one that let them go. Okay, and part of the liberation process for people is being able to identify. It has to do with who gets credit in a way for the liberation, right? You know, it's amazing. I tell certain stories of liberations of people that I work with. And I mean, the other day I had a woman who was released in a very miraculous way. It looked like it in some ways, but there was a lawyer involved. You know, there was a judge involved. And I was involved as an advocate, and I don't want to tell the story in depth, but this woman against all the odds, she was released, and in the aftermath, and but part of what happened is there was a lot of prayer about the situation that went into it, and the release was, this woman was released from a federal judge who was the most severe judge against immigrants in our whole state. And the woman had a severe, heavy-duty criminal record, and this woman is a woman who deports people daily, you know, just piles of people. She's very, very severe, okay? And within the first hour of a four-hour court, this woman, the judge released this woman, and right at the moment when we were, you know, we were praying, and her son was in jail praying for her. And it was just a powerful experience for the son and for us to witness this, and for this woman too. And the woman has since become an active, you know, quite active in our ministry. But in the aftermath of this liberation, and in terms of interpreting it, I mean, the attorney was saying, well, it was the judge. I mean, it was the woman whose testimony was so powerful. She was the one who, because her testimony was so honest, that led to the liberation. And then her son in jail was at first saying, yes, you know, it's God, I believe. And then he started to say, well, you know, my mom has this witch that she goes to. And the witch has always gotten her out of binds. And I really think that it's quite possible that this is what happened. You know, and then in talking to the attorney, well, she was saying, well, yeah, you know, the attorney, this particular attorney didn't do all the legwork. It was another attorney. And she said, that one attorney who did all the legwork, boy, she did a perfect job. The briefs were just wonderful. Okay, and everything. And then someone else was saying, well, no, it was the judge, because see, this judge, when she hears someone really confess and repent, she that's the one thing that can touch this judge's heart, and you know, and this woman did that very thing. Okay, so everyone else was sort of, I mean, there was like a fight for the glory of the situation, of, you know, who was to get credit for this in a way in the dialogues that followed this event, right? And in some ways, I mean, all of these people were right, perhaps, you know, that it was the judge in part, it was Epifania, the woman in part, it was, you know, it was the attorney and all the legal work, but, you know, but was God present in any way? You know, maybe not. I mean, there's always a materialist interpretation of every event, right? There's always an interpretation that is possible that excludes any kind of intervention of God. And Israel is constantly tempted to interpret her history in a way that excludes God's presence. And let me show you, in contrast to verse 17, other interpretations, like when you look at the festival of the Passover, there's a completely different interpretation of what, of who, you know, who did the liberation. Look at chapter 13, verse 3. Someone read that.
Moses said to the people, remember this day on which you came out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, because the Lord brought you out from here by the strength of his hand. No other bread shall be eaten.
Okay, so who is it that brings him out in this case? It's the Lord by the strength of his hand, okay? And then further on it says, verse 5, when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites. Okay, well, remember, we've talked about how God chooses mediators, and God chooses saviors. We have many savior figures, many mediators of God's salvation in Exodus. And the first day we talked about who some of those figures were. The first savior figure was the midwives, Shiphrah and Puah, who were the first people that have names in the book of Exodus, these two Hebrew midwives. Okay, they're the first savior figures. Then after that, we have the Hebrew mothers, who hid, and then especially Moses' mother, who hid Moses. And then the little daughter who went and followed the baby, you know, the ark. I mean, the ark that was put in the river with Moses in it, and then alerted them. And then you have the Egyptian princess, right? And then the Egyptian princess's servant. You have all these female figures that are the savior figures in Exodus, okay? And then finally you have Moses, who's raised up, you know, who's the beneficiary of all these acts of salvation. He himself, after committing a murder and ending up being exiled, God meets him and raises him up and says, I'm sending you, you know, to bring up my people. Okay? So Moses is the one that is the Savior, But and you know, he is clearly the mediator and the savior in a sense. And yet here it's God. It's the festival is not in memory of Moses. It's in memory of God who brought them out by a mighty hand. But then in the very beginning of our text here, it's Pharaoh. Pharaoh's the one that let the people go. So I think this sets the context for understanding a bit the dynamics of what's happening in the rest of the chapter. So what do we know? What just to kind of summarize some of this quickly, it says that God led them away, led them in a roundabout way to avoid bringing them into a place where they would experience conflict. Because if they experienced conflict, they didn't want to go back to Egypt. Okay, this brings up the question of what is the people's role in the liberation process? This is something we haven't talked about yet, but if you look back at Exodus chapter 2, verse 25, where it mentions the first, God is first part of the picture. Why don't we read that really quick? Because this is, we have to look at all of these actors and see what part they play or don't play in order for us to identify where God is actually in the picture. Could someone read chapter 2, verse 24, or verse 23 and 24? And 25.
After a long time, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned under their slavery and cried out. Out of the slavery, their cry for help rose up to God. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God looked upon the Israelites, and God took notice of them.
Okay. Before we ask the question, what was Moses doing when God showed up? Okay, and it was a powerful thing to notice that there was no piety, no evidence of any piety, no evidence of any that he was seeking after God or that he was doing anything religious. Right? God just shows up and calls it. What were the Israelite people doing when God decided to save them? What do we know about the Israelites? Were they
suffering, groaning, crying out, is that?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's amazing. When I ask this question in Bible studies, oftentimes people say, well, you know, they were seeking after God. They were crying out to God. But the text is very clear that, clearly does not give them any credit even for that, right? It just says their cries rose up to God, right? But there's no direct address. In fact, nowhere in this story are the Israelites crying out to God. There's no place up to this point, up to chapter 13 in Exodus, where the Israelites cry out to God. So in this story, the Israelites are passive. Okay, they are completely passive recipients of salvation. You know, this is another one of the temptations, is to say that we had faith and that's why we were liberated. And this is the temptation often of the Pentecostals folks who say, if you have faith, you know, the reason that you're not healed of your cancer because you don't have enough faith. The reason that you are not seeing any signs of God's action is because you don't have enough faith. And there may be some truth to what they're saying, but on the other hand, they're quick to see faith as something that is a work that is critical, a critical part of the picture for their salvation. Whereas in the book of Exodus, the people are completely passive, and this is confirmed by verse 18. You know, God knows that these people are weak, and that there's nothing about the people that makes them strong enough to, you know, to be actually collaborators or active participants. I mean, they're so weak that he has to take them out of the place of conflict, in a way, take them a roundabout way. The reader, we as readers, are alerted to two things now at this point. First of all, that Pharaoh, you know, Pharaoh may be the one that is responsible for this. He is the sovereign, and you know, he is the one that's in control. And in fact, Moses has been going to him and saying, "Let my people go," and you know, rather than just blowing them away in the first place, you know, Moses has been going to Pharaoh, and now Pharaoh's finally let the people go. So, does Pharaoh get the glory? What we know, we don't know that yet, the answer to that question. Do the people get the glory? Well, we know that right now from the start. No, God is protecting them from having to have any faith. Okay, and then we have verse 21, which shows the Lord's complete presence and protection of the Israelites through this initial process of liberation. God is in front of them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them, to give them light. And neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of cloud by night left its place in front of the people. So it's a permanent presence of God that is guiding the people. And then in chapter 14, something really decisive happens. There's a major change. What do you guys see happening, and what are some of the issues that are happening in chapter 14, verses 1 to 4 that we just read? I mean, the stage is being set.
Well, the Lord tells them to turn back, and then he tells them that Pharaoh is probably going to be coming after them.
Okay, who's the Lord saying this to?
Moses.
To Moses, okay. So Moses, as leader, has this inside information. And what is the information basically? What's basically being said here?
The Lord's going to harden the Pharaoh's heart. So that he'll change his mind and come after the Israelites. And we also have the indication that the Lord is going to accomplish a great rescue at that point.
Okay. Okay, what about verse 3?
It sounds like almost like Pharaoh's going to make an attempt of rescue.
That's a good point. I haven't ever read it that way, but that's a possibility. Yeah, we don't know whether he. I mean, because later on
he'll be back to slavery.
Okay, so in a way, one of the ways I read this is like it's like God has is like luring Pharaoh. It's like God's fishing out there. He's got the people, and he's dangling them in front of the Pharaoh. He has them out in a place where. It looks, from the Pharaoh's perspective, these people are just wandering aimlessly. Pharaoh's starting to wonder. Later on, we'll see. What am I doing? I lost this workforce, right? And so the people, they're hemmed in. I mean, there's a description of the people being led to a place where there's kind of a. I mean, there's the sea right here. The Israelites are right here. In the wilderness, then we have Pharaoh, and his armies and everything, and they see the people are stuck. I mean, they're right here. I mean, they've been wandering aimlessly, but they're hemmed in on all sides. They have nowhere to go, and so the scene is being set up for us to see what. What's the purpose of this place of hopelessness.
The Lord said he's going to show the Pharaoh who's boss once and for all.
Yeah, exactly. I will harden their heart, and I will harden his heart now, and he will pursue them so that I will gain glory for myself over Pharaoh. Okay, so this has to do with the question of who really is victor in this situation. Is it Pharaoh who is the sovereign? Is it God who is the sovereign? Right. So could someone read for us verse 5 through... Chapter 14.
When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the minds of Pharaoh and his officials were changed towards the people, and they said, "What have we done? letting Israel leave our service. So he had his chariots made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 picked chariots and all other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the Israelites who were going out boldly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, his chariots, chariot drivers, and his army. They overtook him, camped by the sea, by Pihahiroth, in front of Baal-Zephon. As Pharaoh drew near, the Israelites looked back, and there were the Egyptians advancing on them. In great fear, the Israelites cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the very thing we told you in Egypt? Let us alone and let us serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." But Moses said to the people...
Actually, why don't we stop right there? Sorry. Okay, so what's happening here? What are you guys... What are you hearing? Okay. It's interesting. There are two questions that are almost identical in their phrasing. If you look at verse 5, at the very end of it, it says, "What have we done letting Israel leave our service?" Okay. What does that assume? That question.
It assumes they made the choice that they are the liberators.
Exactly. Okay. And it also assumes that they've come to the awareness that what have we done? They've kind of come to their senses and said, we've let this workforce go. I mean, these were critical people to our economy. Okay, so it's just like they've kind of woken up out of their whatever state they were in after the plagues. And okay, look at verse. Let's see. 11. Let's see, the Israelites. They said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us?" See, that's almost the same phrase. What have we done? Is the question of the Egyptians. And then what have you done to us? Okay. Now what does this assume?
They're being misled too, taken away from what now looked like it was probably the good life.
And that Moses did it to
them. And that Moses did it to them, okay? So in neither one of these phrases is God even part of the picture. Okay. This is something that's so intriguing to me. I mean, throughout the book of Exodus, this is one of the questions. I mean, is God even part of the picture? No, God's not part of the picture. Moses, you're the one that brought us out. You know, there's rebellions against Moses later in the desert, you know, and that's the big question. You know, why did you bring us out here? I mean, you know, so Moses is being blamed for the liberation, or in this case, you know, the Egyptians are blaming themselves for a foolish, you know, kind of economic political move. You know, but God is, you know, God is completely, unbelief is just a major force here. Let us alone, let us serve the Egyptians, for it would be better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. Okay, so people preferred. You know, once the tensions happen, people prefer to go back to Pharaoh. Okay? It's better to serve, it's better to be in this place. I mean, there's great benefits to being under an oppressor, you know, whatever that is. You know, whether it's a 9-to-5 or, you know, or a 12-hour day work week or work day or whatever, whatever the things that enslave people, there's just tremendous benefits to that. And people, I mean, what Exodus tells us is that is that, you know, when the liberation process begins, don't expect it to be easy. And you know, and that, and the difficulties provoke unbelief, promote unbelief. You know, what would be some of the benefits of being with Pharaoh? What are some of the benefits that the people are articulating here?
They get fed on a regular basis.
They're protected.
Okay. Protection. What else?
I don't know what to expect.
Okay. So they know what to expect. Predictability.
They don't have to make decisions.
Don't have to make decisions. Exactly.
Have some sort of a home to go to every night.
A home, exactly. I mean, they move from a place of having a home, you know, in although in bondage, to a place of moving. I mean, here, you know, they're perceived by Pharaoh, the unbeliever, as wandering aimlessly, right? But we've just been told that the Lord is ahead of them in a cloud, a pillar of cloud, and you know, and a pillar of fire, and all the stuff's guiding them and continually, right? Okay, well, from the perspective of Pharaoh, I mean, they're just wandering aimlessly. You know, it's amazing. I mean, there's the eyes of unbelief that are constantly being, the interpretation from the eyes of unbelief that is constantly just woven through this narrative. And you can see the, you know, sometimes when I've read this in the past, I thought, this is just too crazy. These Israelites are so stupid. How can they be like that? How can they be so fickle when they've just seen this liberation process? But this is, you know, the more I work with people and the more I know, I get to know myself, the more I see my own, you know, my own forgetfulness. I mean, you know, the human, we are so inclined to forget any signs that we've interpreted to be God's presence with us. You know, unbelief reinterprets those events to be, you know, to kind of exclude God from the picture completely, right? And like in the case of my friend Epiphania, her son who was at one point was crying with joy and just giving thanks to God for liberating his mom, and the next time I visit him, he was saying, yeah, you know, my mom visits this witch. You know, unbelief, right? Reinterprets the event and takes glory away from God and gives it to something else. Okay, so if we were to look at this situation in a modern context, the Israelites at this point have Pharaoh bearing down on them. Okay, so they're facing. I mean, they're on their way out towards liberation, but they have, you know, they have 600 chariots. And then all the officials, each one has an official of Pharaoh. All, according to the text there, as Pharaoh drew near, the Israelites looked back, and there the Egyptians advancing on them, in great fear the Israelites cried out, okay? Or even before that, the Egyptians pursued them, and all Pharaoh's horses and chariots. Okay, so we have, this is the positive side of what they have. The negative side is that they're oppressed. Okay, forced labor, military state, right? Police state. No freedom. And here they're looking at major sanctions, you know, the possibility of just being all completely obliterated, or, you know, major persecution anyway when they're leaving. So 600 chariots, the officials are bearing down on the people. What would be some modern equivalents of this, you know, for us today?
I'm thinking that if you leave the oppressive force, which is in some cases the 8-to-5 job in a cubicle, you don't have any, medical coverage, you don't have insurance or life insurance, so there's no long-term financial provision, which is something that we all rely on heavily.
Okay. So if you decide to go out and to leave your particular job situation, which you may not be happy in, or maybe you're happy there, but you receive a call to go into some unknown territory, you know, you feel like God is calling you to take a step of faith out in a different direction. You have a dream. Okay, that might be one of the things that would keep. That might be one of the voices that would cause you to think twice or more than twice. Just the possibility of losing a pension, you know, losing security. Okay, for sure. What else?
Then I also think that there's a responsibility, the oppressive force, you might say, would be responsibility that we have been taught, we think we have, to the rest of our family. Often it's a financial responsibility, or maybe it's a role model, and that if we veer off into this place, then we are neglecting our responsibility to be a responsible parent or citizen.
Okay. So just the moral morality of the status quo and a whammy, the view of the responsible parent who is providing financial security for children and also is a role model, of a responsible parent, whatever, responsible citizen. That's a huge force, no doubt. So the possibility that people might look at you and think, what's happened to her? You know, crazy. Look, she's gone off the deep end. She's giving up everything. I mean, is this a midlife crisis or what's going on? Any other ideas?
I have. Mm-hmm. I think we're the guys in the chariots, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, we're usually asking, what have we done to let these people get away with this? We better go after them.
Okay, like which people are you thinking of?
Well, talk about law and order. You got a crackdown on this, that, or the other.
Okay.
Or maybe on both sides of it. Times when I've been involved in situations where there's, say, domestic violence, and finally you're working with, let's say, the woman, the wife, mother in this, and finally find a safe house where she can go and get away from a bad situation in that, and she's there, and you have her set up, and after a week later, she decides to go back home, back into that oppressive situation, and in the same time, working with that husband, that father, I mean, when all of this has been going on, I mean, he's driving his chariots. He's pursuing, saying, what have I done? And those two things keep going on simultaneously.
Now remember, in our story yesterday, we saw that the officials were, some of Pharaoh's magicians and officials began to be influenced by the plagues and by Moses' presence, and began to fear God. Okay, so even among the oppressors, there's a movement. In fact, God's whole purpose of allowing the plagues on the Egyptians is so that they might know the Lord. Okay, that's something that's repeated over and over and over. In every other plague story, there's a mention of, hey, these plagues, they're going to happen so that Pharaoh and the Egyptians might know that I'm the Lord, and so that they might believe, right? Okay, so when we try to identify ourselves, you know, we may be Pharaoh, we may be Pharaoh's, you know, we may all of us be able to identify ourselves in Pharaoh's camp and simultaneously in the Israelite camp. I mean, our particular location in the narrative doesn't have to be one or the other, it could be both. You know, maybe even Moses, maybe we even have a role in some way as a Moses figure simultaneously. When I think about myself, I think I can identify myself practically in every one of these three. We don't have Moses there, but Moses is with the people. Okay, and then we have God, who's also with the people, but you know, as a shield, whatever. So when we try to identify ourselves, you're saying that we can be Pharaoh and his officials. Last month, I did a Bible study with a bunch of released inmates and a bunch of my students from Vancouver down in Burlington in our storefront, and we had four guys that had just come out of jail. And we read the story, we got right to this point, and I said, okay, well, where are you guys in the story? And the four guy inmates, they said, oh, you know, we feel like this, we feel like Israelites, we feel like we're just completely up against a wall. And, well, so what would be the, what kind of pressures, what kind of forces are you in your lives? You know, what would be Pharaoh and his officials for you guys? And it was very easy for them to identify Pharaoh and his officials. They said the Department of Probation. You know, they're requiring that we show up during work hours. Okay, so how are we supposed to get a job if we have to show up once a week at 2 o'clock in the afternoon? You know, because the Department of Probation workers have a 9-to-5 job. You know, the Department of Licensing, they've taken away our licenses. We can't get our licenses back because we have to pay our fines, but our fines are in collection. And how are we supposed to work to pay our fines off so that we can get our license so that we can drive to work if we, you know, if we can't drive to work, okay? And then someone else said, well, the CPS, Child Protective Services, the whole time I was in jail, this guy had come to me a couple days before, and he said, look, they garnished half my wages. You know, he'd gotten a job, he was making minimum wage, and he was living, he was together with his wife and kids, right? But when he was in jail, his wife had to collect welfare, right? And so he was being treated as a, you know, as an absent father, and so they were collecting. He had a debt to pay to the state during that whole time, as if he had abandoned the kids, like child support is what it was. So child support was being garnished. 50% of his wages were being garnished, and he was totally frustrated. He just says, "I'm going to go back. I'm going to start selling drugs again. I can't handle it. You know, what do I do?" And I ended up helping and calling and, you know, getting through this very difficult, complex telephone system. You know, push one if you want this, you know, and push two after this if you want this, and finally you get to a human, or you get to a voicemail message, right? That says leave your message where you can call back. Well, these people don't have a telephone, so how are they supposed to leave a message? And that's the same way with the Department of Probation. If you want to tell people what's going on with your case, you have to deal with a message machine. If you don't have a phone, you know, you're just stuck completely. So anyway, the forces that these people felt were up against them were, you know, were family issues too, you know. Like my wife, she's depressed, you know, and she's unable to do anything in the house. And so I come home from work, and none of my kids have eaten lunch or dinner. And there's no food in the refrigerator because, you know, my wife's sleeping, you know, and so I got that too. And I got, you know, they identified this huge list of things that they're up against that made them feel like they were right here. And so I said, well, what do you feel like doing? What is your, you know, what do you feel like doing when you feel these pressures with Pharaoh and his armies? One of the guys said, cocaine. You know, I feel like going back and get using crack. He said, it's much. You know, it's for me an escape. You know, it helps me. And the other guy said, "Man, I have to confess. You know, yesterday I spent the day drinking." You know, and another guy said, "Yeah, you know, for sure. You know, I mean, I have to confess that I did start selling again. I started selling crack. You know, I started selling crack 3 days ago. You know, and that particular guy ended up getting arrested 2 days later, and he's still in it. He's got a year in the jail now." Okay, so most of the people who make up the underclass in that I work with, they clearly identify themselves here, and they don't see any solution but to go back to, you know, to whatever the forces are that oppress them. But see, we're given an opportunity because, see, the plagues, the judgments, and everything to Pharaoh and his officials all have a purpose, you know, which is to, that the Pharaoh and his officials might know the Lord. And when the Israelites leave, they go out in a mixed company. There are Egyptians that go out with them, okay? There are, there are included among the Israelites all kinds of folks. And if they aren't now, they will be later, because God's whole purpose through the Israelites, through calling the Israelites out, is to be a blessing to all the nations. All right, so here they are. They're stuck in a completely, in a no-exit situation. Let's see what's going to happen. Well, anyway, to follow up on Michael's point, in the case of my inmate brothers and sisters, clearly the oppressors are, I mean, you know, we are among the oppressors because we're the citizens that pay the taxes and that vote in all these harsh measures to kind of make the underclass buckle, you know, knuckle under and behave themselves, you know, and, you know, it's very easy for me to see my own place there in terms of looking at modern equivalents. Could someone read for us verses 12? Let's see, where do we end? Verse 13 and following. Verse 13 to 18.
Which chapter?
Chapter 14.
But Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm and see the deliverance that the Lord will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to keep still." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry out to me? Tell the Israelites to go forward. But you lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the Israelites may go into the sea on dry ground. Then I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them. And so I will gain glory for myself over Pharaoh and all his army, his chariots and his chariot drivers. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gained glory for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots and his chariot drivers."
Right. Okay, so here we see that this place of being, you know, this place of being stuck, this place of bottoming out, this place of crisis, is actually part of God's. I mean, you know, it's described as a place that the Israelites were actually led to, right? With what purpose? You know, why are they brought to this place of utter hopelessness?
To see the deliverance of the Lord.
Okay. Exactly. It's interesting. The first time that you have the Israelites crying out to the Lord is in this verse in Exodus. First religious gesture or posture, really, that you have in Exodus.
What about verse 14? The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to keep still.
Yeah.
Just shut up.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay, but without that word, see, the people are just in a situation of hopelessness. Without hearing that word, they are in a place of utter despair. You know, see, they're right. If they're not getting, if that word's not being addressed to them, they're right to want to go back. I mean, you know, my inmate friends, you know, most of them never have anyone addressing them with that word. Never anyone accompanying them and standing with them and saying, "Look, just be still, okay? And look and watch and wait, you know, for the deliverance of God." You know, instead they're choosing what just appears to be the only solution, you know, back to dealing drugs, back to crazy life, you know, the woman who leaves the shelter to go back with her husband. You know, the anxiety of her own, loneliness of her own, and just her own pathological sort of attachment to an abusive husband, whatever. You know, those sorts of forces, unless people can really hear that word and be encouraged to stand in that place, you know, of total vulnerability, really. You know, and total dependence. And even if they are encouraged to do that, doesn't mean they're going to do it. Right, because this is a very scary place.
So it's really the same verse as "Be still and know that I am God."
I think it's the origins of it, probably, of that psalm.
Well, they have a strong mediator in
Right, right, right. And so Moses has a critical role. Say more about that. What is Moses' role in this picture?
He's going to be the intermediary. He's going to act on God's behalf to demonstrate what God's power is.
Mm-hmm. He has the good news, right? He's the one that addresses the people with the word of hope in this situation of total bleakness. And without that minister of the word, who's right there to speak the word at the place of crisis, at the place of darkness, you know, it's hopeless, right?
Yeah, it's not only a word, but he's going to be right with the people too.
Yeah,
he's not going to.
Well, he's in probably the most vulnerable place of anybody, because
yeah.
I mean, he's the leader of the people, and if anyone's going to get strung up, it's Moses, right?
Yeah.
He's the one who has the different perspective, the vision of God.
So here we have a response to this whole question that we've been looking at. Well, who gets glory for this? I mean, you know, who is the author of this liberating event? And can we say more about the Israelites and their particular participation in this? At this point, we see it's the Lord and we see it's Moses. What about the Israelites?
Well, even though they are told to keep still, a verse or two after that, well, the next verse, Moses is to tell them to go forward. And it almost sounds like they're supposed to head forward whether they know what's going to happen or not.
Mm-hmm. Right. So they're invited to take a step into the darkness. They really are.
But they seem so clueless. So much of the time. Most of the time, no matter what happens, in the whole wilderness story, they don't seem to get it. They never, no matter what happens, they still just kind of go, look around and they don't get it.
Well, look at this cry of even their piety here. Then they cried out to the Lord. I mean, is this a piety? I mean, is this an authentic sort of spiritual cry? I mean, look what follows. They cried out to the Lord in verse 11. Then they said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the very thing we told you in Egypt? Let us alone, let us serve the Egyptians, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." So we can see that, I mean, if they cried out to God, it's kind of like a jailhouse, religiosity, right? I mean, in the worst sense of the word, there's a great jailhouse religiosity, too, that's an authentic cry, I think, that I see often. But in this case, it's a cry that is like, there's no other, I mean, there's no other, they're using it as just a cry of last resort, right, which is followed by a complaint. So the Israelites are completely, I mean, they're passive beneficiaries of God's salvation. So they can't get any credit for this in terms of their faith. Okay, the Egyptians certainly aren't getting any credit, for the liberation of the people. Nor are they able to win the people back into their clutches as they hope. Okay, so the contest. This is the decisive moment when the contest between God, who is God, is fought and won. Happens in the following chapter, or the following verses 15 and following, if you don't have time for.
Well, just the one thing about the graves, that kind of, where they're complaining to Moses, well, are you taking us out because there aren't any graves for us? In my mind, I'm thinking that has a connotation of tradition, and so in a way the people of the Israelites are oppressed by their tradition, which is to say that everybody has to have a grave. And so then they're projecting their fear of having to move away from this tradition onto Moses.
One of the things we see in the book of Exodus all the time is that what brings people to a place where they're truly, the kind of the ultimate model of spirituality in Exodus is there is no model in terms of a piety, right? That we see the people modeling. The people, what they demonstrate is faithlessness and unbelief constantly. And what God continually demonstrates is just this persistence at moving them from place to place, further along in the liberation process towards freedom, right? And this is done through Moses the mediator. But it seems like the time when God is constantly allowing the people to get to this place of utter hopelessness, like the prodigal, who sort of bottoms out, or like the person in AA who finally comes to the place where they say, hey, I am powerless. I am powerless over my addiction. We really have a spirituality of the 12 steps in the book of Exodus in some ways. At least in the first two steps of the 12 steps. The rest is kind of getting to a different kind of morality oftentimes. Maybe they can become a legalistic morality. But what we have in Exodus is people coming to the place of crisis. And it's that place at the very bottom that is the context in which God acts consistently throughout the book. Anyway, we're out of time, so. Tomorrow we're going to be looking at temptations in the wilderness and sort of what are the temptations of once you are free.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.